Thank you. Let me start on a note of optimism first. It was 3 years ago, a little more than 3 years ago, that we started Media Workers Against the War, and there was then a ban on those of us who were against that war and probably against all wars. We weren't really allowed in the media, and because of the organisation we formed and the movement that gathered so quickly, we were able to not only oppose the war, but actually get onto the media to oppose it and to express the misgivings, if not the outright opposition, of a large section of the population of this country. So I say to you, take heart from that, because from these beginnings, on a subject every bit as vital, if not more so, at the moment, we can go a very long way. I'd like to mention my own personal experiences with not discovering racism. I've had plenty to do with racism in many parts of the world, but discovering it here over a period of 5 years in the 1980s, that is, discovering its true violence. I knew five families in the East End, although one was an individual, four families and one individual. Most of them were scattered throughout housing estates. One family lived in a cul-de-sac. All of them were extremely vulnerable. I knew them over this period of time and often went to see them. I wrote about them. And one particular family I got to know extremely well, and I stayed with them on a number of occasions. This family was attacked weekly, sometimes nightly, over a period of 5, 6, 7 years. There was a lull for some unknown reason one summer. But most of the time, they were attacked. They lived upstairs. They couldn't go downstairs after 7 o'clock at night. They kept a dog downstairs. The father was a tailor. He couldn't practice as a tailor. The teenage daughter huddled upstairs by candlelight, keeping a diary of the attacks. She often used to ring me and I would hear the attacks going on. I'd hear the bricks behind. This young woman was like an Anne Frank with a telephone, and I exaggerate not. After I spoke to her over a period of time, frankly, I didn't believe, I have to say, that it was as bad as it was until I went to stay. And one night there was a particularly vicious attack while I was there. And we all huddled as the bricks bashed against the door. And after the teenage daughter, who really was the strength of that family, she was the one who could speak fluent English, she could communicate with the outside world, she rang the police. After her father had already rung the police, they used to do this every night, no one turned up. This particular attack started just after midnight and ended about 3 o'clock in the morning. The attackers left in almost a nonchalant way. They got tired. They were exhausted. The point was that nothing stopped them. Now, when I wrote about that particular family and the other families, perhaps the stories of the other families weren't quite as dramatic, but they were just as awful. There was an incredulity. People were horrified. I remember coming back to the Daily Mirror, for which I then worked, and having a discussion with people about, they weren't questioning the truth of the story, but they were saying, sure, it's extraordinary, you know, in this country. People shook their heads. Now the point is about that, as I was to discover, staying in contact with these people over a number of years, is that this kind of attack in Britain has been common for a very long time and is common today. Another Britain exists in this country which just is not reported, and for newspapers like The Independent to lecture us about how they're going to save people from the skinheads is absurd. Because when they get down to not sending reporters to write respectful pieces about Eric Beacon, but to actually, and not to debate fascism, but to investigate it as journalists, professional journalists, investigate it and to expose it. Perhaps then things will perhaps start to look respectable, truly respectable in the media. I think it's absolutely crucial, as all the speakers before me have said so well, that we identify these thugs and say who they are, spell out the inhuman and manipulative and essentially violent nature of their ideology, fascism, which I think Tony Benn defined so well. But I also believe that we mustn't separate them from the other lot. I think they are an extension of an established order that has, over a period of time, become itself extremist. Perhaps the outsider in me still says that it's a curiously British illusion that the far right inside the Tory party are respectable. They're not. Look at the cabinet. I think the far right of the Tory party have spawned the BNP. The BNP have come out. The BNP has sensed a favourable climate, and that climate has been created for them by the party of government. It's also been created for them by a history of complicity with racism in both parties. Some of the most inhuman measures, the immigration bill and others, were enacted by the Labour government. Back to the time of the Home Secretary, Merlin Rees. Back to the time of the Home Secretary, James Callaghan, as he panicked people from East Africa, where I was at the time. I think we're now seeing the product of that. But I think before we've seen the BNP, we see extremists within the government. And I think the two are connected, and I believe it is dangerous to disconnect them. There are thugs in pinstripes. I also think there's a curiously British way of looking in the media on ourselves as being sensible and quite different from Europe. It's the Basil Fawlty view of Germany that suggests that Germany is full of Nazis in the streets and we're not. Well, I wrote last week in the New Statesman, at least in my copies I gave to Steve, that there were 70,000 racial attacks in this country every year. He corrected me and said there is actually a Home Office figure. It's 130,000. That makes this country every bit as racist, fascist, and as violent as Germany and as France, but it's manifest in a different way here. That's why I say that we watch the BNP, because like any disease, the BNP will grow if it is allowed to let grow, if it's allowed to grow. But the conservative government itself is responsible for the studied indifference of a police force that did kill Joy Gardner, the studied racism of those who guard the gates to this country, that did accuse a plane load of Jamaicans of being gangsters, the kind of studied racism that black people meet when they confront the lack of employment prospects, the bureaucracy, and so on. We talked about balance earlier, and I think we should have a think about balance. I'm been accused of being one of the most unbalanced Is that right? I once had some programs that went out, they were so frightened. One of these programs, I should say, was about a black family in the north of England, and I did it for ITV in the 1970s. And this program and others was considered so unbalanced that at one point the then IBA, an independent broadcasting, whatever it was, decided that there had to be sort of cigarette-type warning statements before and after this program. And the night before it went out, it was to have a warning statement in the middle. So a half-hour program had to be stopped, which it was in the end. It's beginning and end. You are watching a personal view, and at the end of it, you have watched a personal view. But that's the sort of absurdity. And it was this particular program that exercised them. I have to say, they did go off and find a series of balancing programs, and I'm personally responsible for launching the fortunately short television career of Auburn Wall. It was that particular program on race and the attacks on this family that exercised them about balance. And it seems to me that we really haven't come all that far when responsible quality newspapers can produce, and I'm afraid we're giving the Independent hell tonight, but that's their fault, not ours, can produce this kind of piece in which Derek Beacon is written about. One of yours, I asked, the reporter is with him in the Isle of Dogs. One of yours, I ask. Beacon looks at me pityingly. Still don't understand, do you? They're all mine here, son. Now, subtly, and not so subtly, the central assumptions and lies of the BNP are not challenged in this piece. Now, this isn't the worst of the pieces that we've seen and will see, unfortunately. This is probably average. Now, the writer of this, John Giraud, has written a rather hurt letter to the New Statesman, which will be published tomorrow, in which he talks about his professional objectivity and said he strayed from his professional objectivity by saying the chances of the BNP doing well, I think, I paraphrase him, were depressingly, and he repeats it, depressingly high. Now, everything else was professionally objective except the use of that word, and then he betrayed his true beating liberal heart. The argument on balance, I thought, as far as attacks on people because of the colour of their skin, the attacks on people because they are the objects of fascism, as Tony Benn defined them so well, I thought that argument had been won. I was wrong, it hasn't been won, and it has to be won all over again. There are a number of people from the media here tonight, as there were during the meetings we had during the Gulf War. I think we went some way to persuading those people from the media that there is a way, another way, of looking at their jobs. All right, they can't change the system overnight, and the state, you will say, and I will agree, is inherently racist. And this, of course, flows on naturally into the media organisations, but media organisations are made up of people and individuals, and some of them in very powerful positions. And they don't have to be at the top of the tree. The Time Watch program, which I'm not sure if it was Seamus or Victoria who mentioned, it was the sort of program that gave you the impression, and here one was overwhelmed by charity, that they couldn't really have put this program on and walked away and said that's a balanced program in which all views have been given, when Mr. Bean, a co-founder of the BNP, and Enoch Powell dominated a panel discussion on the history of immigration. There are people who make those programs that really now have got to start examining their own journalism. It's just not good enough anymore, that kind of platform, that kind of almost extension of instant respectability to people like that. Powell has been given respectability since his vicious racist speech in 1968. I went through the cuttings today about Powell. All I can find is praise for the man. You know, he's put forward as either a great orator or a great classicist. My mother ran into him at university once when he was at the university in Sydney and said he was a dud. What is this about this man? She said. He wasn't any good. But for some reason, mostly the quality liberal press have elevated Powell, and there he is, now not too coherent perhaps, still being elevated on a program like that. I don't think there's a lot of difference between the classicist Powell, some of the more extremists in the Tory government, and Derek Beaton of the BNP. I think they all come out of the same mould, they express it differently, and they all have to be opposed. And the idea of giving the voice of racism and fascism equal time, the equivalence that Steve spoke of, is outrageous. That word normalisation is a very, very good one. When you look at normalisation and look through the process of how atrocities can be normalised, it's quite interesting. Auschwitz had to be designed. The architecture of the death camps had to be designed efficiently. In the end, the people who did it were normalised. We're part of a normalizing process. A better type of napalm that didn't stick to the skin, called napalm B, which was used in the Great Laboratory War in Vietnam, had to be found and developed by people who went home at night and played with their children and so on. That's a normalizing process. Now, I could work through it, and it's quite obvious what I'm saying. But the point is that the part of that normalizing process, integral to that normalizing process, is the media. They can normalize violence by distortion, by accepting it, by giving respectability to those like Beacon and his gang. When we have headlines that have been common in the British press, such as black crime, the alarming figures. Now that particular story some years ago, and there was a whole raft of these headlines, was actually the opposite of what was true. At that time, there were some of the Home Office's first statistics released about racist attacks in this country, and it showed that Afro-Caribbean people were 36 times more likely to be attacked than any other ethnic group in the country, and that Asian people were 50 times more likely to be attacked than any other country. And when I look back on this and look through all the papers at the time, and we're talking about in the early and mid-80s, most of the papers to prepare the ground for this, with Home Office files being showed to the Daily Telegraph and the Daily Mail publishing leading articles, headline, how they've tricked us, and referring to tidal waves of people. Journalists really have to examine their work if they're anywhere near that kind of pollution, because it's powerful. No one underestimates the power of the media. The media is more powerful than it's ever been. We live in a so-called media society, which is said to be an information society, in which we're saturated with information. We're not. We're saturated with media, most of it repetitive, most of it shoring up prejudice and stereotypes, and no more in the field of race, and no more in its lack of opposition to racism and fascism. As I sat through Schindler's List the other night, thinking, having been to Auschwitz, having interviewed a lot of people who have been through that period, having read considerably about it, I didn't think I needed to see it. I was painfully moved by it. And near the end, I kept thinking of, do we have to wait all these years to have such a wonderful movie, leaving people ashen-faced and some of them sobbing, but certainly moved and certainly informed as they left the theatre? Do we have to go through that again? I thought again how so much of our reporting of the world is in racial terms. I was thinking about the genocide that I've had something to do with reporting lately, that of 200,000 people in East Timor, a third of the population, killed by the New Order fascism, and it is fascism in every way, their ideology, the way they behave, their attacks on people for their culturally and ethnically and so on. This is racism and fascism. But this is a government that our government and the media have for years called moderate and stable. It's like what Victoria was talking about with Mozambique. It's the same thing. The same reporting, the same distortion extends to our view of the world. Those people were allowed to die over the past 18 years because they were the wrong colour skin for a start, and second, those who were killing them were our friends, for whom we distorted, and the media had distorted, the language so that we could anoint them as respectable. And the same is true when you bring it down to the microcosm of these people in Tower Hamlets at the moment. I think many journalists would do well just to even examine the way they can be manipulated by what Dr. Johnson once called the tyranny of the stop response, which is built into the sort of hackneyed view of journalism that has to go along a certain route. There are two sides to everything, even if one side happens to be fascism. That's nonsense. And people's intelligence ought to overcome that. Certainly young journalists who are starting in the media can address that now, I hope. As I said earlier on, I feel that individuals can do something. They can object if a fascist is brought onto a program. They can, at the very least, insist that a member of one of the anti-racist organisations, ourselves or any of the others, it doesn't matter, but somebody who can contradict them, not from ignorance, but with the power of experience and knowledge. It just simply comes down to that we may be a long way from seeing black shirts in London, but I'm not sure that we should be looking for black shirts. The fascists, when they get into the streets, they may well look like skinheads, but they may also look different from what they from the fascists of the 30s. Fascism has come back. It's come back throughout Europe. There seems to be a need to give it some respectability. I was going to quote, and I will. I was going to quote. I'm sorry, the Independent. Another piece. I shouldn't have done it. Patricia Clough is writing in the Independent from the Italian election. She wrote some very good analytical pieces. But she saw in the leader of the Italian fascists, Fini, and I quote, a personable, decent young leader who had shoved the fascist immigrant-bashing skinheads into the background, so transforming it into a respectable, Gaullist-style European right-wing party. Right? Now, this appeared the day after Fini gave an outdoor press conference on election night, surrounded by 1,000 thugs giving the fascist salute in central Rome. Film of this appeared on News of 10. And a few days later, Patricia Clough herself was forced to report Fini's interview with La Stampa, in which he described Mussolini as the greatest statesman of the 20th century, and that Berlusconi would have to pedal hard to show that he belongs to history like Mussolini. Therein lies the danger. The leap from respectable fascism to street fascism is not a leap at all. Thank you.